Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insider's insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, it's been 3 years since the earthquake devastated Haiti, followed by the spread of cholera, bouts of civil unrest, and Hurricane Sandy, which destroyed some 70% of the country's crops. We'll explore how Haitians are rebuilding their lives. Then on the Scholar Circle, most Americans revere the U.S. Constitution, but some scholars say our problems in the U.S. may be rooted in that founding document. We'll dissect some of those provisions and the culture that keeps them in place. It's been 3 years since the earthquake in Haiti took some 200,000 lives and left 1.5 million people homeless. Over the last 2 months, observers have noted that Haitians continue to struggle because of cholera, harsh living conditions, inflation, civil unrest, and Hurricane Sandy, which destroyed some 70% of crops in the South. We're joined by Jonathan Katz and Manolia Charlottin. Jonathan Katz is an award-winning journalist, former Associated Press correspondent and editor, and author of The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. Manolia Charlottin is the executive editor of the Haitian Times, the former editor and business manager of the Boston Haitian Reporter, and a news commentator on the African diaspora. Welcome to the two of you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Manolia, I would like to start with you. What is it that you think we need to understand about the pre-disaster Haiti to understand the context of today?
Well, there's two ways for me to frame that. One is the disasters that preceded the actual earthquake. And then two is sort of like the cultural and the sense of rehabilitation for many folks in the diaspora who had started to go back to participate in different rebuilding efforts before the earthquake. So I'll start with the preceding disasters. Of course, the earthquake happened in the context of capital city being over inundated with millions, but it's only designed for several hundred thousand. And that occurred over time. But the last sort of major migration occurred during the late 80s, early 90s, when the U.S. and other international actors helped develop a policy to kill the local Creole pigs, as well as the rice policies in terms of the subsidies that occurred under the Clinton administration. So these sort of last two agriculturally based things devastated a lot of the markets for the farmers and the peasants who live in the countryside and became sort of the last major migratory reason for them to move from the countryside to Port-au-Prince. I mean, there are plenty of others, but that's sort of the overarching. And, of course, the political reality at this time is the dictatorship had fallen, and so Haiti was in a transitioning into a democracy in which it held its first sort of free elections, at least in the modern times, electing Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And, of course, after, you know, he was detained in a coup twice, the second coup happened much more recent in 2004, and this sort of created a very deep sense of instability politically, as well as crime rates started to really soar in the more lower-income neighborhoods of Port-au-Prince. And so you had this happening between 2004-2006 on sort of the political instability. And Puyvale comes into power during his second tenure, in which he's able to sort of calm things down with the help of international community that sent the UN peacekeeping effort that's there today. And so that's sort of the more structural, political, and economic.
Sorry to interrupt, but I'll throw in one more thing, which is that, especially since the fall of Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier in 1986, but even going back a little before that, one of the major things that happened in the relationship between Haiti and the rest of the world is that countries like the United States, like Canada, like France, the other major powers, more and more started trying to go around the government paying NGOs, private organizations, their own government agencies to carry out work that otherwise might have been done by the state. And so over that period of time, the state has become more and more and more dissolute and less and less able to respond to crises.
So it couldn't actually generate the kind of legitimacy because it was maybe disempowered to some extent. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, legitimacy is one thing, but even before you get to legitimacy, there was just pure capability. If you have a disaster in Los Angeles, The first people that you expect on the ground are firefighters and policemen and paramedics. And then pretty quickly after that, you would expect for the Federal Emergency Management Agency to show up, maybe with the new structure of our government in the United States, the Department of Homeland Security, or, you know, some officials from the military. In Haiti, there really wasn't much of that. There wasn't when the earthquake struck, there wasn't really a fire department that could come out. There were police, but they weren't organized. They weren't drilled in emergency management response. There was a Department of Civil Protection, but I was there. Obviously, I survived the quake and was there in those days after, and you never saw civil protection officials anywhere. It took weeks for them to, you know, start getting their act together, just enough to be able to respond. Haitians responded. There were, you know, Haitians saving Haitian lives, neighbors saving neighbors, relatives digging through the rubble to save their family and their friends and their enemies, and then just, you know, anybody who was around. It took about a day for the first organized, equipped foreign responders to get in. I'm not trying to negate that part of the history, but what there should have been and what there should be now are agencies on the ground in Haiti that are Haitian institutions that, thrive and survive and develop on their own, that are in place when a disaster strikes so that they can respond. And one of the great failures of the reconstruction, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, has been that those agencies have not been strengthened or put in place.
To put that into a context, before the earthquake, you have to understand Haiti was already reeling back from another major natural disaster, which was the hurricanes of 2008. So the reason why I give all that history, and I'm so glad that Jonathan jumped in, is because you have a state that was already dealing with all the structural challenges and all the foreign intervention challenges, but it was also dealing with its own sort of disaster beforehand. So the summer into the fall of 2008, the whole sort of northwestern and central plateau and the main sort of the main city and areas that produce rice in the country was completely flooded. And some of the images that we were seeing were sort of, for instance, you know, Wyclef Jean and some of the celebrity actors that he brought down helping people through the floods. And so Haiti was already coming off of the heels of natural disasters, in addition to the lack of capacity that Jonathan referenced.
Now, Jonathan, you actually detailed how some of the money, like in 2007, for example, where they went. And that was pre-earthquake as well. If you could detail just a bit of that, and then did you also do the same thing post-earthquake aid and break it up in terms of where it went?
Sure. We really saw the same story all over again, just writ on a much larger scale. In 2008, as Manolia said, there were four tropical storms and hurricanes that struck over the course of a month. And the worst damage, certainly the most visible damage, was in this northwestern part of the country, especially a city called Gonaïves. That's a port city on Haiti's west coast. And that same city, 4 years prior to that, in 2004, had been struck by another tropical storm that approached in almost the exact same way, burst basically the same river at the same point, flooded the same city, and that time actually killed thousands of people. The only reason why fewer people died in 2008 than had died in 2004 really was that the recent memory of that flood, as soon as word came coursing through the town that the water was on its way, people threw down their possessions and up and left, whereas they hadn't necessarily a couple years before. And in that time, in those 4 years, there were some very big promises made, you know, fairly large amounts of money pledged, nothing in anywhere near the league of the amounts that were talked about after the earthquake, but millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars that were pledged to help Haiti be more resilient and better able to weather storms like that in the future. And it was, I don't know if it was misspent, but it certainly wasn't spent in a way that had any lasting impact on the ground. A lot of money was spent on financing a report. The U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, helped finance a report on all of Haiti's watersheds and the flood risk for all of Haiti's cities. It's an excellent report, really nice, very long, detailed, good charts, a lot of really useful information in there. But it took so long to do the report that by the time they actually decided to start implementing its recommendations, they could only do it in basically two small areas where nobody lived and which actually weren't even that high on the risk of flood potential. And in that time, once again, as if by clockwork, there was another storm, another set of storms, and the same city flooded again in the same way with very, very tragic results. And then at the time, and I talk about this a little in my book, President René Préval went to the United Nations in New York for the annual meeting of the General Assembly, and he gave a speech in which he thanked the nations of the world, the members of the United Nations, for having come to Haiti's help after the storms and for having, you know, provided money for recovery and for relief and reconstruction. But he said at the time that, you know, what you're doing isn't going to be lasting. And he had this statement in which he said that, you know, he knew that they would very soon be going away again, and that Haiti would be left on its own to confront the next catastrophe, only to have the aid groups and foreign responders return as if, in his words, a ritual of mobilization. And we could talk more about what happened after the earthquake, but really, even though the numbers are bigger, it was the same kind of thing happening all over again, just on a much, much bigger scale.
Do you have a sense, either of you, Manolia first, about what was driving the policies, say, in the Clinton administration, post-Clinton administration, now the Obama administration, or is it just lack of really a thorough understanding?
I wanted to sort of talk a little bit more about NGOs, because Jonathan brought up a really important point that they had become a really important force in the country's infrastructure. Another book that was just released by anthropologist Mark Schuller called Killing with Kindness actually examines the structure of the NGOs and the NGO sphere that enabled the inadequacies to continue and that actually became the main arbiters of this failed policy on the ground. And so the NGOs, because they had received so much funding, both from their government, including U.S. government, and were seen as the main purveyors of policy on the ground in terms of implementing programs, they had sort of a different structural relationship to the aid than I think most Americans and many of us even realized, given that they had their own civic infrastructure. The way that they operate is very in a very divisive manner. And so it doesn't engender a sort of comprehensive, multidimensional approach. And there is very top-down. The way the policies in which these NGOs, respective governments, interact with countries like Haiti. And so the exact policies are a failure in themselves, and therefore all the supplemental components of the policies, i.e. the NGOs, are failures. But the actual approach, the top-down approach, is the more root, the more structural problem that I think that Jonathan addresses by the end of his book, to sort of talk about how we even approach policymaking and aid, the aid industry in general. This sort of top-down approach that does not take into account local efforts is not actually good for us. We're not getting the best bang for our buck, for lack of a better term, in terms of implementing better policy that can better serve American interests in Haiti. So the failure of the NGO structure to deliver aid and to also support recovery is actually hindering American interests on the ground. And so I think that that's a broader way to look at the problem as opposed to just dissecting actually what happened. Because if the approach doesn't change and just the same old, you know, let's try a new program approach continues, then we will continue to have the same problem.
And I would say motivations can be very hard to parse or to get at, but the simplest way to look at it is this is the status quo, and it's very hard to change the status quo, especially if anybody is in any way gaining from it, is profiting from it, and people certainly are. There's a very large aid and development industry. These non-governmental organizations and government contractors are quite large corporations. You know, some of these pull in billions of dollars a year. And then spend quite a lot of money, you know, thousands of dollars a year lobbying Congress to make sure that that money keeps flowing. I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a total lack of understanding. You know, the people who are making policy in Washington and people who are working on the ground tend to understand quite a lot. Their after-action reports are some of the most damning pieces of reportage about the problems with the aid effort and the failures in Haiti and elsewhere. But there's so many people, there's so many reasons not to change. Another one is just that it really would challenge our assumptions about the world and the way that we relate to other countries in a way that might be uncomfortable, because it may take you know, it may force us to reexamine some of our notions about, you know, whether other people in the world are just sort of inherently victims who are waiting for us and need us to come and save them. It may cause us to call into question our own ability to deal with certain circumstances. You know, I mean, it's a very hard thing to ask, what should we do when we see a disaster overseas? And we want to send help of all kinds, but, you know, while search and rescue teams are very important and maybe they can be brought in to help with, you know, the most difficult cases as best they can. An American official's approach to the Haitian earthquake in 2010, thinking that there was going to be no rescue effort on the ground other than that which was brought in. But the people who came in, you know, they started arriving like 24 hours later. It cost, you know, millions of dollars to bring them in. But U.S. rescuers, for instance, were only able to rescue 47 people in the time that they were there at an extremely high cost. I think that number's right. I apologize if I'm mixing up the numbers in my own book, but it's very close to that. And that's a big issue. That's part of the reason why it's so hard to change.
Both of you have brought up an interesting point, which is this idea that maybe we have to rethink the entire approach that we have to things like disaster and how we view particular regions and peoples. Maybe it's not this rescuer victim, which brings up the narrative idea, like what Wesleyan anthropologist Jeannie Athena Ulisse has spoken about with Haiti. She says Haiti needs new narratives. Manolia, would you agree with that? And if so, what are the narratives we are dealing with, and what should we be thinking about?
The history of the Haiti narrative and countries like Haiti narrative is a very long one, but to really shorten it as much as I can, it started with the first U.S. occupation. And so something happens when our country goes abroad and defends its interests, especially if it's either military or political or economic interest, in which our government comes back and sells this notion of what the other peoples are like. And so this narrative about Haiti is actually very long. It has a very, very long history from voodoo, which is sort of like the primary cultural religion and sort of the way it's been stigmatized and relayed to as sorcery, from the images of refugees coming in by boat during the 80s and 90s, fleeing from political and economic unrest. And so this negative narrative is a long history, but it's also ingrained in American society and in the American psyche. It's the idea that whatever we do to the other or on the other soil is in our best interest, because look, those people don't even know any better. And so what I think is challenging that naturally is that there are so many Haitians who live here and who call themselves American, and America is their home. I think one way to start addressing this new narrative, and it has started to occur in a broader mainstream media outlets, is providing platforms for Haitians to speak about what's going on in Haiti, for them to talk about what their efforts are. I mean, the diaspora is probably the most untold story of the earthquake. The diaspora mobilized so much money and goods and resources and served themselves as resources and still continue to this day to be supporting family, to be building schools and wells. So they're a major mobilizing force of support and a lifeline back home, both emotionally, socially, economically, and culturally. I think that they can be a real instrument or a real resource to the broader mainstream narrative in terms of finding out how best to represent Haiti and Haitians in the mainstream. But you have to care about that, right? You have to care about the other to even care about learning about the other's culture and how you should talk about the other. And this is what Gina, in her work, has talked about in terms of the othering and what that does and how that enables us as a mainstream society to then create narratives around peoples from those cultures. And so Haiti, even though Haiti is the second oldest country in the Western Hemisphere, its story is not as well told and it's not as well known with its oldest neighbor, the United States.
Jonathan Katz.
I just wanted to go back for a second. I did look it up, and the six U.S. Rescue teams were deployed at a cost of $49 million. And they rescued only 47 people. So that's a very clear area. If you imagine how far $49 million could go in terms of setting up, you know, a Haitian disaster response department, you know, rescuers who are on the ground permanently and ready for the next disaster, how much farther it could go than trying to spend it all at once, like you're cramming for a test at the last minute. And that's part of this issue, part of this narrative. Part of the problem is that it is often very hard for us to see people in other countries and other cultures across divides of race and language and just our preconceived notions about how other people in the world live as being maybe even fully human or certainly fully capable of the things that we are. And this idea that Haiti is this place of magic and sorcery and weirdness and you know, these mysteriously resilient people described often in a way that almost makes them sound something other than human, as if in their DNA is coded a way to react to crisis and disaster, something different than in our own. I mean, it really blinds us to the possibilities. And, you know, I mean, just using that one example, it's fresh in all our minds, you know, that idea that we have to come in and do the rescues and that the people there wouldn't be capable of doing it, even with the right training and the right resources, that applies to healthcare, it applies to food production, it applies to employment, it applies to governance, it applies to law enforcement, it applies to all these different things, and avoiding that is what is avoiding really making Haiti the place that we have promised ourselves and that Haitians want it to be.
Jonathan Katz and Manolia Charlatin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Jonathan Katz is an award-winning journalist and author of The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. Manolia Charlatin is the executive editor of the Haitian Times, the former editor and business manager of the Boston Haitian Reporter, and a news commentator on the African diaspora. When we come back, should we change the U.S. Constitution? That's next on the Scholar Circle. Stay tuned.
Our statues, the soaring edifice of our times, detracted from the ways of the wise. The future will view all history as a crime. So, Father, tell us when is the time to rise? They crown the sun.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. For decades, the U.S. Constitution has been treated as a sacred document that should not be criticized. But some scholars say that many of the provisions within the Constitution are at the root of the problems in the U.S. in governance, in policymaking, and in political discourse. What are the problematic provisions and how can they be addressed? We have three experts with us. Sanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and most recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Louis Michael Seidman is also with us. Louis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law School. His books include Silence and Freedom, Our Unsettled Constitution, A New Defense of Constitutionalism and Judicial Review, and his latest on constitutional disobedience. Professor David Law is also with us. He is professor of law and political science at Washington University in St. Louis. He is co-author of The Declining Influence of the United States Constitution and The Myth of Imposed Constitutionalism in Japan. Thank you for being with us. We have two of you who have argued that the Constitution is archaic. And Michael Seidman, you have even said downright evil. Sandy Levinson, you've called it imbecilic and maybe even pathological. Some pretty strong words. I thought we should get to why we use such strong words, starting with a historic perspective. Michael Seidman, let's start with you here. You argue that the original framers really have no sense of what we're facing today. And furthermore, constitutional disobedience has helped the country grow and prosper. Give us some examples of this.
I'm happy to do that, but first let me just, maybe this a quibble, but I didn't say the Constitution was evil. I said there are some provisions in the Constitution that are evil. The Constitution also has lots of good things in it, and to the extent that there are good things in it, we ought to follow them not because they're in the Constitution, but because they're good things. But to the extent there were bad things in it, there's no reason to follow those just because people 200 years ago thought that they were good things. Now, in terms of the history of this, there actually is a long history in our country of skepticism about the Constitution. It really goes back to the founding. Certainly the anti-federalists who opposed the Constitution had lots of doubts about it, but some of the people at the Constitutional Convention had doubts as well. In the Federalist Papers, the phrase parchment barriers appears in a number of places, and what was meant by that was doubts that a piece of paper could actually protect basic liberties. On top of that, Thomas Jefferson was a complex and sometimes contradictory thinker, but throughout his life, he voiced deep skepticism about the constitutional enterprise, and the most important decision of his presidency, the purchase of the Louisiana Territory, he himself thought violated the Constitution. And a number of other great presidents, including Wilson, Lincoln, both Roosevelts, in one form or another, at one time or another, expressed pretty deep skepticism about the Constitution. So my own view is constitutional skepticism is as American as apple pie. It is part of our tradition.
Sandy Levinson, you've also looked at historic aspects of the Constitution and its strengths, its workability, when it seemed to work better for the U.S., when people were willing to talk about it. What would you add to this?
I think that the primary mistake we make is to assume that what by stipulation might have made sense 200 to 225 years ago really is good for us today. I don't engage in much of what I call founder bashing. I think that the people who wrote the Constitution were facing real problems and did the best they could. The problem is that we have tended to treat them not simply as wrestling with the problems of their own time, but as making decisions for our time. And I think that what is imbecilic is the way the Constitution structures our politics today and the extent to which we venerate the Constitution rather than engage in rational scrutiny. What I most admire about the founding generation was their ruthless attitude of rational scrutiny toward the Articles of Confederation and their view that they and we should always learn the lessons of experience. And I think that part of those lessons, a very important part, should be the extent to which the Constitution doesn't serve us well today, as well as, you know, the extent to which there may be some admirable parts about it. But I think that we are so inflicted with in a culture of Constitution worship and founder worship that there is nobody on the national scene who is leading any sort of serious discussion of the adequacy of the Constitution. And I think Mike made a very, very important point when he said that many of our most important presidents have, in fact, tried to lead national discussions about the adequacy of the Constitution. And that is what is wholly and completely lacking in our politics today.
What I'll want to get back to, of course, is even if we were to find these flaws, something that you've pointed out, Sandy Levinson, which is that it's nearly impossible to change it. One other note, you mentioned how much we are attached to this document. I think it was Robert Dahl who called it a civic religion, that people treat it like a religion. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. The first book I wrote was called Constitutional Faith, and it really tried to develop the religious overtones that are attached to the Constitution, I think much to our detriment.
This is Mike Seidman. If I could just add to that, I've had some personal experience with this just over the last week or so. I wrote a column in the New York Times that made many of the points that Sandy just made so ably. I've gotten over 1,000 emails since then from many, many people who acted as if I had attacked their religious beliefs, that I was attacking God and the Bible. It was just really an extraordinary reaction. And what's so puzzling about it to me is I would have thought some propositions were really just, to coin a phrase, self-evident. And one of them is, this is our country. We live in it. We have the right to have the kind of country we want to have. Nobody would be happy if France told us what kind of country we had, or the United Nations told us what kind of country we should have. So it seems very odd that people should feel so strongly that these folks who lived over 200 years ago, who know nothing about our current life, who are all dead, and who probably did not represent a majority of the country even when they spoke, that they should have this kind of dictatorial control over fundamental aspects of our polity. It seems really strange that anybody should think that, much less that they should feel so strongly about it.
I would say part of those may have also come from the headline the New York Times gave your piece. I think that scares people.
This is Sandy Levinson. If I can jump in for just one moment and offer a slightly different perspective. The Times published my op-ed, and they called it Our Imbecilic Constitution. And I got a lot of the same kind of responses that Mike is describing. But I would also emphasize that there was a decent percentage of responses of the type, kind of, finally, I thought I was the only person who thought there was something screwy about the Constitution and the power it gives small states in the Senate, or the difficulty of change, or the Electoral College, or some of the other problems. A number of people have pointed out that currently roughly 20% of the American population describes themselves as religious nonbelievers, but they're really almost frozen out of the public discourse because every at least elected political leader seems to feel some necessity to indicate religious commitments. So I think that there is actually some portion of the population that might be open to a serious discussion of constitutional inadequacy, but our elected political leaders, including the two Harvard graduates who ran for president just a couple of months ago, are providing no leadership whatsoever in having any kind of discussion about what a 21st century constitution might look like.
And that's something we should talk about in a bit as well. But let's bring in David Law. Professor Law, you have looked at this constitution in a comparative context. How do others deal with this, and how does the U.S. Constitution fare in the course of history?
Other countries are much more serious about revising and updating their constitutions than we are. It's a bit ironic that the U.S. pioneers this idea of self-determination by committing oneself to rules and principles that are the result of rational self-deliberation. Let's get together and write a constitution, actually put down on paper how we think things should work. And then we turn around and we're the one country that actually doesn't ever really do this anymore, right? So Jefferson urged we should have a constitutional convention every 19 years. That actually turns out to be the average lifespan of a constitution. The average lifespan of a constitution is 19 years. Ours is 225 plus years and counting. So faced with the fact that our constitutional operating system is equivalent to Windows 0.1, other countries see and recognize this, and they look at the formal document and they go, look, even if we wanted to copy the American constitutional system, we would not start with the document. We would not take this large C constitution. Instead, we might look at their small C constitution, which includes, you know, their judicial opinions, it includes their statutes, it includes their practices, it includes their conventions, but we certainly wouldn't adopt this thing that they've got called their constitution. So one thing that's clear is other countries don't consider the document as it currently exists a good template. And I think given that we have this old unamended document that doesn't even describe what we do, you know, doesn't mention political parties, which are fundamental to our system, it doesn't mention the administrative state, which is fundamental, it doesn't mention the concentration of power in the presidency, president now being directly elected, you know, there are two options that make sense, right? We could actually try to revise the Constitution and address its most glaring defects, which Professor Levinson and others have urged at length and in various works, including Sandy's book, Undemocratic Constitution. That's one option. A second option that's reasonable is we could give up on the idea that the Constitution sets forth binding legal rules that address contemporary disputes and view it instead, as Mike urges, as a work of art that is designed to evoke mood or emotion rather than a legal document that commands specific outcome. whether or not one agrees with Professor Seidman's position, whether or not we agree that we should detach from the Constitution, if we don't fix it, if we don't update it, we are in fact going to increasingly detach from the Constitution. Whether or not we agree with this prescription, what he's describing is in fact going to happen increasingly. So what I think all three of us agree on is that relying on the current Constitution in its current form is a non-starter. But we seem to be stuck with that thanks to some combination of ancestor worship, treatment of the Constitution of civic religion, and the sorts of things that Sandy's mentioned. Pretending we're governed by this thing, this U.S. Constitution, rather than this larger mass of things, the statutes, the conventions, the understandings, Supreme Court decisions, that's a legal fiction. You know, it's really an act of ventriloquism. It's getting the document to say what nine justices want it to say, right? That's not really the Constitution. Don't look at, I think Mike likes the expression, the man behind the curtain, right? So what you see front and center on stage is the large C Constitution. That, as a descriptive matter, that's no longer the way that things are done. And other countries recognize that, and that's why they don't use the U.S. Constitution as a template anymore.
This is Mike Seidman again. If I could just add to that, I think David is absolutely right that one of the problems here is a kind of willful blindness or hypocrisy about what's going on. But there's another problem also that neither David nor Sandy's mentioned, and that is that our addiction to the Constitution tends in an unhelpful way, I think, to raise the temperature of political debate. Think, for example, about gun control, which is a subject that Sandy has written more perceptively about than anybody, I think. The issues about gun control are authentically hard, and people feel strongly about them, and of course there's going to be argument about it. But what happens when the issue is constitutionalized? Well, that has two really unfortunate effects. One effect is that means the lawyers get a hold of it, which means the lawyers do what lawyers do, which is to say they read the text very carefully and they look at the history and try to figure out the connection between the English Declaration of Rights and the Bill of Rights and so on. And they end up talking about stuff that's profoundly irrelevant to the issues today about guns. But the other thing that happens is once it gets attached to the Constitution, then we're not just having a policy disagreement or even a disagreement about philosophy. We're having a disagreement about the nature of the United States, and people start accusing other people of violating our foundational charter and so not being real Americans. And this is a serious obstacle to having the kind of discourse that in a rational, mature democracy we ought to be having about issues that matter.
So what you're saying is it's having a silencing effect.
I'm not sure silencing is quite the right word. In some ways, it's the opposite. It causes people to start yelling at each other instead of listening to each other.
This is David Law. I would just add, I agree completely with the point that Mike is making. The constitutionalization of public policy disputes is democracy stunting. Rather than folks, you know, I was born and raised in Canada, and if you have a policy issue in Canada, you ask yourself, what makes sense? What should the country do? What should the government do? Increasingly, the same sorts of questions come up in the U.S. in the form of, well, what does the Constitution command or forbid or require? And if the idea of democracy is we're supposed to be responsible for ourselves, we're supposed to engage in self-determination. Instead of engaging in self-determination, we engage in this pseudo-historical inquiry into what we think people might have had in mind 225 years ago. That is not democracy.
Sandy, I heard you coming in. Sandy Levinson?
Yeah, I agree with both Mike and David. I think Mike makes a very important point that lawyers take over the show, I think generally to our detriment. For me, the worst example of this has to do with the issue of impeachment. I happen to think that one of the real defects of our political system is that we can't fire a president in whom we lose confidence. During the Clinton administration, obviously, we went through this charade of impeachment, and it turned out to be lawyers fighting one another about the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors, instead of having what might have been a more cogent discussion of whether Bill Clinton's behavior had simply so disgraced the presidency that he should have the decency to leave, as would have happened, I think, say, in Great Britain, or whether, to take a much more telling example for me, whether one had really lost so much confidence in George W. Bush as the commander-in-chief that he should be fired. We can't have that discussion because there is no procedure for a vote of no confidence. Instead, lawyers shout at one another about impeachment I think, to our detriment. And as Mike said, with regard to gun control and with regard to so many other issues, this is the way too much public discourse proceeds in the United States. I'd like to make one other point, a kind of modest disagreement with what David Law said. One of the real anomalies of American constitutional politics is that we venerate the United States Constitution and find the idea of a new constitutional convention almost literally unthinkable. But if you look at the American states, there have been over 225 constitutional conventions over our 200 years. Each American state has had an average of nearly three constitutions. So if you look at the practice of Americans at the state level, you find kind of a marvelous willingness to treat constitutions instrumentally, to ask how do they need to be updated, to amend them. Indeed, the usual critique that a lot of people have about state constitutions is that they're too easy to amend. But it does seem to me that Americans have a curious sort of schizophrenia, where at the state level, we've been remarkably creative with some frequency in revising constitutions, and at the national level, we're really stuck in the late 18th century.
Stay tuned.
Don't you all know? Don't you all care? Don't you all see how this is unfair? Are we all blind? Do we not see? Do we not bend to misery? Of course we all know. Of course we all care. Of course we all see how this is unfair. We are not blind. Yes, we do see.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're exploring America's reverence for the U.S. Constitution and how to address the problems that arise from it. Sandy Levinson, let me engage you on this just a bit. Because of the gridlock that you have written about, and I think that some of the other professors have also, some people argue that the gridlock is, to some extent, a good thing because it acts to prevent bad laws from being enacted, especially in light of the way the interest group power has grown in the lawmaking process, and it prevents certain majorities from oppressing minorities or limiting their rights in some way or another. But even with the states changing their constitutions under the umbrella of, say, the Bill of Rights, which, as we know, did not come with the original Constitution, but it prevents those states from violating rights, like we saw some in California, for example, but it is now traveling to the Supreme Court. So do you see any good in the gridlock?
It's undoubtedly true that the harder it is to pass legislation, and at the national level, it is almost incredibly hard to pass legislation at times, it's going to block some terrible legislation. But it will also block good legislation. And I think that we have to decide ultimately what we fear more, which risks we're most obsessed by. One thing we learned from an early age in America is to be almost obsessed by the problem of tyranny of the majority. And therefore to say, well, the way to prevent tyranny of the majority is to make it very, very difficult, at times nearly impossible, for the majority to govern. That does, in fact, protect us against those majorities that want to be tyrannical. It does nothing whatsoever, however, to protect us against minority tyranny. That is a tyrannical status quo, whether it's slavery, patriarchy, or other kinds of examples that we could give, where the near impossibility of change simply freezes into a kind of permanence an unjust status quo. Frankly, I would rather run the risk of having legislation passed that I really don't like and then rely on the next election to throw the rascals out and repeal their bad legislation than to continue with a system that makes it nearly impossible to confront any of the great issues that face us in the 21st century, whether you're on the left, right, or center, that each of us has a menu of issues that we really have to confront. And I think that one of the things that unites the Tea Party with the Occupy movement today is the well-merited belief that if you look at Congress, they're incapable of responding adequately to any of these issues. This is one of the things I think that accounts for the fact that Congress has an approval rating these days of about 12 to 15%.
Before we dig more into this, I really would like to hear from David Law how other countries and other constitutions deal with these kinds of issues.
I would start by saying that most countries have a more healthy relationship with their constitution than we do, in the sense that they are willing to work with it and they do not fetishize it, put it on a pedestal. Most countries approach the document more as a functional thing, a thing that sets forth how the government's supposed to work and is a framework for government, and rather than something that they're afraid to touch, something that sort of exists behind plexiglass, museum glass. And that means that constitutionalism in other countries looks like constitutionalism, as Sandy described, at the state level. Other countries are willing to revise their documents on a fairly frequent basis. So they don't have to read into the Constitution things that aren't there. In terms of the fear of tyranny of the majority, a lot of countries have the opposite concern, which is the fear of what the French call gouvernement des juges, you know, government by judges. There are a lot of parliamentary systems in the world that are premised on the idea of a more pure democracy, one that can't be stopped by the judges. Who elected the judges anyway to say what legislation can or can't be passed? But the trend is toward increasing acceptance of judicial review and increasing willingness to allow the judges to enforce the Constitution. If there is a global trend, it is in fact in favor of allowing the courts to limit the scope of legislation in the name of the Constitution. But that's less dysfunctional when you're willing and able to revise and update your Constitution on an ongoing basis. If you actually work with your Constitution and you update it, you're not tying yourself to what people did 225 years ago. You're tying yourself to decisions you made maybe 10 or 20 years ago, which is vastly more reasonable.
Michael Seidman.
You know, it seems to me when you asked Sandy how you balance majority against minority tyranny, you asked him exactly the right question. And the point I'd like to make is the problem with constitutionalism is that it takes that question off the table. So when Sandy talks about the fear of minority tyranny, he's very persuasive. And when I've listened to him, I think, you know, he's probably right. When I hear other people on the other side, I have some sympathy with them also. This is a hard question, and it's one we need to grapple with. But as long as you have Constitution worship, we can't even talk about it, because the Constitution, for better or worse, sets up a system, and the assumption people have is that we're stuck with it, and therefore it's not worth talking about changing it, or worse yet, if you even think about changing it, you're some kind of commie un-American. And so we never get to the hard and important questions that Sandy has written about in his last two terrific books.
Where do we go from here? Sandy Levinson, you have talked a bit about doing some kind of constitutional convention. You've talked about ensuring that you leave out particular kinds of people, namely the Congress. How would you see something like this going?
Unfortunately, almost any answer sounds quixotic, precisely because there is no national leadership and there's no mass movement. That being said, what I would hope is that people would realize that we really do need to confront the Constitution as a whole, and the best way to do that by far is in a new constitutional convention, and the Constitution itself contemplates the possibility of new conventions. There is a procedure by which Congress must call a convention. I think Congress can call a convention at its discretion. One of the reasons I would exclude Congress is not because I necessarily have contempt for Congress or people who serve in Congress, but Congress, to put it mildly, has more than enough that it needs to be thinking about besides the very, very serious questions of how best to design a constitution fit for the 21st century. So one of the reasons to have a constitutional convention is precisely so you could have a group of people who would have the time to debate one another, presumably on C-SPAN, so it would become a national debate, about what sorts of institutions would well serve us, and then to make proposals to the country. I find my own ideas quite reasonable, but I also think it's quite obvious, as I say, that there is no movement that is pushing them, and there is nobody at the national level of politics who's really willing to take any sort of lead. And that's what I find so completely dispiriting, that you have pundits across the political spectrum who increasingly describe the American political system as dysfunctional, even pathological, but they're unable to connect the dots and to say that the Constitution makes its own contribution to the dysfunctionality of the pathology. Instead, they denounce the political leaders they particularly don't like, whether it's Barack Obama or Mitch McConnell, or they denounce talk radio, or they denounce the role of money in politics, all of which might be relevant. But nobody is willing to say, as both Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt did 100 years ago during the 1912 election, that part of what ails us is the Constitution itself.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're exploring America's reverence for the U.S. Constitution and how to address the problems that arise from it. I wonder, you mentioned the money in politics issue, and that does seem to be the issue that might bring another amendment forward. The president himself has said he would support an amendment to overturn Citizens United.
This is Mike Seidman. Finally, I think you have a little disagreement between the three of us. I'm not in favor of a constitutional convention, and I'm not in favor of constitutional amendments. Just as I resent people who died two centuries ago ruling us, so I don't think we have a right to rule people two centuries from now. And the problem with a constitutional convention and with amendments is that, again, they are efforts to entrench the status quo. So the one sort of amendment I would favor, or the first business of a constitutional convention, if we're going to have one, would be amending Article 5, which provides for amendments and making it much easier. But even if that were done, I think a lot of the pathologies that we've just identified would also attach to a trying to write a new constitution. So again, it raises the stakes. Again, it turns attention, I know Sandy doesn't favor lawyers doing this, but it turns our attention to lawyerly-like skills, drafting language, trying to find the future, trying to establish for everybody what kind of a country this is. I think all of that's bad. I don't think we need a constitutional convention. I think we need a change in our culture. Now, how do you bring that about? Sandy's right. Anything you propose is certainly going to sound quixotic, but cultural changes happen at the ground level first, and we could all start the process by the next time somebody says to any of us, that's unconstitutional, we should say in response, so what? And if enough people do that, then people are going to start wondering, so what? And then a lot of things that don't seem possible now might suddenly become possible.
Now all my listeners are going to call me a heretic. David Law, was that you coming in?
Yes, if I may. I agree with Mike that amending Article 5 would be a great idea, making constitutional amendment a little easier. We know as a matter of actual empirical data that constitutions that are too difficult to change, that are too rigid in a sense, don't have the same longevity as constitutions that are a little more supple. Now, obviously, the U.S. Constitution has done a great job, even though it's been very rigid. But on the whole, a little flexibility, not too much, but a little flexibility turns out to be good for constitutional longevity. Now, if you make the Constitution easier to change, then the difference between the Constitution and a regular statute becomes a matter of degree rather than a matter of kind. Countries have this document called the Constitution, but it's not entrenched. So there are really, you know, two separate questions here. Do you want to change the Constitution or ditch it? And do you want the Constitution to be entrenched? And I'm not sure how Mike would feel about this, but I guess I'll throw it out to him as a question. How would you feel about a Constitution that is not much more, if at all, entrenched than a regular statute, which is what a lot of countries have? That would certainly lower the stakes of what you put into the Constitution, wouldn't it?
You're exactly right, David, that it's a continuum. And if you're all the way over on one end of the continuum, so the Constitution is, in effect, just an ordinary statute, then most of the objections disappear. The one place where I still have some reservation is there is this attitude of reverence toward the Constitution. It's just drenched in normativity. And if that survived a weakening of Article 5, then I think that would still be a bad thing, but it might not survive. And if constitutions were just like statutes, then I wouldn't object to constitutions because they wouldn't be constitutions. They'd just be statutes.
If I can jump in one more moment, where I most strongly disagree with Mike is that I think that it's very, very important for constitutions to establish certain institutional practices, like, for example, how many people will fill certain roles, how will they be elected, how long will they serve, how can you get rid of them if you, in fact, become disillusioned in them, when are they going to be inaugurated? We're going to have inauguration day next week, and that's a fixed part of the Constitution. I think it's stupid, personally, and I would change it, but I would not support a system whereby, for example, we said that a president will be elected and will be inaugurated whenever reasonable and can serve as long a term as is reasonable. So it does seem to me that there is something to be said for certain kinds of hard and fast institutional rules. I certainly strongly agree that we need to be able to amend the Constitution more easily when we do discover that a hard and fast institutional rule that might have made sense many, many years ago just doesn't make so much sense for us today. But I would not really wish for the United States to rely completely on the good faith of people who currently hold political power to decide how long they want to remain in power. That's where I draw the line with regard to the importance of certain sorts of constitutional rules.
Which is interesting because judges, of course, get lifetime appointments.
Right, which I think is a mistake. Most countries have term limits or age limits, and I think we'd be far, far better off if we emulated most other countries, and for that matter, almost every American state, only one or two of which have life tenure.
It's a perfect place to end. Let me thank the three of you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Sanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith and, most recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Louis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law School. His books include Silence and Freedom and his latest on constitutional disobedience. Professor David Law is professor of law and political science at Washington University in St. Louis. He is co-author of The Declining Influence of the United States Constitution and The Myth of Imposed Constitutionalism in Japan. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from scholarcircle.org. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.